Hello, how are you? A big welcome to episode 47 of the Baltic Triangle podcast with me, Mick Ord.
And me, Mark Reeson. Firstly, let's apologise, Mick, for missing out on an October episode. Unfortunately, time ran away with us a little, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And we're supposed to be monthly, and we missed 1 month. However, we did have August, and a lot of podcasts didn't take place in August. So I think it does deserve an apology. I've had people coming up to me and saying, where were you in October? And so now they know, don't they? You know.
Dude, let's just put it down as annual leave.
Yeah, okay. All right, good one, mate. In this month's episode, we have a treat for all you meat eaters so the veggies can put their hands over their ears. We hear from an award-winning charcutier, and the company really has won lots of awards. Founded by a Scouser, Andy Rogers, who trained in the Pyrenees with one of the world's top charcutiers, and he now produces his free-range pork from, where else, Bootle.
The whole point of as good as I can make it in terms of, you know, using the right animals, that means animals that have lived outdoors and that have been grown slowly, that can cope with living outdoors because they're the British breeds. They've had a better life, so the welfare is very important. But for me, as important as that, not less or more, as important is that that kind of animal, when treated like that, tastes better too. And so that's the best of both worlds.
And we'll be hearing a lot more from Andy shortly. Mick's been meeting the author of a brand new book about the Scouse dialect, Professor Tony Crowley, a professor of linguistics who blows away a lot of the myths knocking around about where the famous Liverpool lingo comes from and where it's going.
It's very highly stigmatised, and yet it's spreading, Mick. So now, if you go to St. Helens now, the younger generation in St. Helens sound as though they come from Liverpool. The older generation, and particularly the older generation, they sound, to use a term which some people might find offensive, they're woolly backs, right? I mean, like the older generation, but the kids sound as though they come from Liverpool.
Yeah, we'll be hearing from Tony Crowley a bit later. First of all, a big thank you to the Baltic Creative CIC. Their sponsorship contract with us has ended, but many thanks to them for the past year. We're now looking for new sponsors. A new sponsor for our monthly edition of the Baltic Triangle podcast. So if you'd like to sponsor us or you just want to find out more, then please email us.
Yep, the address is info@baltictrianglepodcast.com. And it is quite an exciting opportunity, obviously, to be involved with what we do. Remember, at the very heart of it, what we do is we tell positive stories about Liverpool. And as Mick rightly says, the movers and shakers.
Yeah, that's right. Over the past couple of years, we've had Baltic Broadband sponsoring us. We've had Talk Talk for a couple of months as well. And most recently, Baltic Creative CIC. So if you want to get in touch, whether you're a public or private enterprise, then get in touch with us.
Well, Andy Rogers certainly has a story to tell, which is why he's a guest on this episode of the Baltic Triangle podcast. After spending several years working in the foothills of the Pyrenees in France with the master charcutier Philippe Cam de Borde, and learning the skills of his trade there, he returned to Liverpool 10 years ago, thoroughly convinced that there would be a marketplace for such produce in this country, and how right he was. A charcutier, by the way, is a fancy French term for a pork butcher, a person who prepares and sells pork products, bacon, ham, sausage, patties, you name it. A master charcutier is a real expert. And it's the title of master charcutier that's associated with the very best practice in this profession, under laws first set out by Louis XI in the 15th century. Andy Rogers came back to Liverpool, as I said, in 2013, and he now runs his own charcuterie. It's aptly named North by Sud-Ouest. He's won countless awards in the British Charcuterie Awards and the British Cured Meat Awards, just to name but a few. And I was lucky enough to go down there and visit the Centre of Excellence, where I caught up with the man himself.
My name's Andy Rogers. I run North by Sud-Ouest Charcuterie with my wife, Dot. And I've been a chef for getting on for 20 years now. And I went and worked in France for a bit. And while I was in France, I worked for a charcuterie out there. And then I came back and did some normal chefing for a bit. And then I've sort of slowly segued into doing this charcuterie full time.
Let's talk about where we are. I mean, I pulled up outside here this morning. It's not far from where I live. And it's an industrial estate in the middle of Bootle.
Yeah, bucolic bootle. It's by ours, you know. And so I live in Seaforth. I come here to work. When I first started the company, I was working in a butcher shop on the Wirral, Edge & Sons, which is one of the best butchers in the country. And I used to work in the back of his shop, mainly when he wasn't there, because it's a super busy place, you know, like they've got loads of butchers, not a lot of space. And I would come and work in the evenings and overnight sometimes to get my stuff done at the same time as having a job. I did that for like 3 years before I then had the wherewithal to open my own place. And so obviously I wanted it to be a bit closer to home. Although to be honest, like Scousers are so obsessed with like it's so separate, Birkenhead, isn't it? Or the Wirral generally. But it's actually much quicker for me to get to Birkenhead than it is for me to get to Speke or even Alton Road or somewhere like that, you know, where I used to work. It's like 20 minutes in the car, but the tunnel is such a barrier. It's 5 minutes drive from my house where we are. It's rustic in a kind of a industrial way, and it's not got too many beautiful trees and meadows and cows and whatnot, but you'd be surprised how many farms there are actually not far away from here at all. Growing up in Liverpool, you just don't associate that kind of thing at all with this area. But the quality of the farming just the other side of the water is like top notch, you know. And Callum Edge, who's the guy, the butcher that I was talking about, has spent his career developing links with these really good farms who do everything free range. They're using British traditional breeds, you know, rare breeds. And they're within, I think his shop, they have like a 30-mile radius sort of policy for all the farms. And I remember when I found that out, I was staggered. Like, because I know him through being a chef, so I was a customer of his as a chef. What I could afford to get from him, I would get from him, you know, within the constraints of kitchen budgets, and it would be special. And so we sort of developed a relationship from a good few years ago now. And then when I started getting more and more interested in pigs, he was the obvious guy to sort of get in touch with. He finds me my pigs and I turn it into the charcuterie.
Don't get me wrong, I'm delighted you're here in Bootle. I'm absolutely delighted where you are. I think it's really important that people do realise that right under their noses, across the whole of the region, there's incredible things happening, and that's a lot of what we often discover on the podcast. Let's talk in generic terms then about what charcuterie is and how it translates into English.
Okay, so charcuterie is basically pork butchery in essence. In France, you'll get a butcher's, a boucher, and a charcuterie, and they're not the same. Like, one sells beef and lamb, and the other sells pork. And so some of it might be fresh, some of it might be cured. And what we tend to understand it as in this country is cured meats. In Italy, they call it salumi. So cured meats in this country is basically things like hams, pâtés, terrines, salamis, normal sausages, that's a cured meat. That kind of thing. And I specialise in air-dried products mainly. So that's things like air-dried hams in the style of, you know, a Serrano ham or a prosciutto. Salamis, I do them with a sort of a French slant because I've worked in France for a number of years. That's my influence is French. But I don't sort of slavishly follow any rules that, oh, this is a French thing, this is a Spanish thing, this is an Italian thing or German or whatever. I do what I'm interested in. I have broadly French names, but, you know, whether you call it a French name or Italian name or a Spanish name, it's still fundamentally the same thing. What gives it character and point of difference is the animals that are getting used and the person who's making it. For me, that's more important than whether it's a saucisson or a salami. You know, it doesn't matter that.
Thinking about that then, how important do you think it is that you've got a business, especially in the current times that we live in, that is responsibly sourced, sustainable, and has a lot of the right procedures from field to fork, as it were?
I mean, for me, like, I wouldn't be interested in doing it if it weren't like that. The whole point of as good as I can make it in terms of, you know, using the right animals, that means animals that have lived outdoors and that have been grown slowly, that can cope with living outdoors because they're the British breeds. They've had a better life, so the welfare is very important. But for me, as important as that, not less or more, as important is that that kind of animal, when treated like that, tastes better too. And so that's the best of both worlds. It's coming from around the corner from here. And so the, you know, the food miles are drastically minimised by not getting it from left, right and centre and through big wholesalers. I deal with a butcher and he deals with individual farmers, and I've met these farmers, and so we have a relationship, you know. If there was more of that in the food chain, then we would be in less dire straits than we currently are, just generally speaking. It's not necessarily the solution for everything, but I do think that there's a lot to be said for, you know, eat less meat, but eat better meat. It's quite simple. Not everyone's into it, but I think that there needs to be a conversation about that. Like, the more we can talk about it, the more we can get people to think about it, because you don't have to spend all day thinking about anything. I think the more of a future we've got, really.
How do you think you're regarded on the estate?
I guess I'm regarded on the estate in the same way that I'm regarded by my friends. They're baffled, you know? I pretty much turn up, say hello to the mechanics or whatever, close my door and then leave, you know, 12 hours later or whatever. And, you know, so I'm sure they're amused by what I do, as are my friends. You know, they're sort of be amused.
Provenance aside, I think one thing that stands out about the products that you make and you sell is just the quality of them. I've seen you doing stuff by hand. I've seen the setup you've got here, and it's by no means Heath Robinson. It's as state-of-the-art as you need it to be for what you need to do. Talk to me a little bit about something that you make and how you make it and why it's different.
Sort of my snazziest product, if you want, is my air-dried ham that I call the Jambon de Bayars. It's a culatello-style ham, right? So most people don't get the joke of the Jambon de Bayars, but anyway, never mind. Let's draw a discreet veil under it. Anyway, so it means little arse, you know. So it's the ham, the bottom of the pig, taken off the bone carefully, and then tied up very tightly, and then put in some sea salt with a little bit of wine, a little bit of garlic, a little bit of pepper, and nothing else. And then after the salting process has happened, it goes to the fridge to do that, right? And then the salt is drawn into the meat. Then it gets tied up in a natural skin with a lot of ties. Like, so I'm embarrassed to tell you how long it takes me to do these things, you know? Like, it takes a long time to do one. It's like knot after knot after knot after knot after knot after knot. When you finished it, you stand up and you straighten your back and you go, oof. But it's a very beautiful thing. It looks sort of like a rugby ball shape, and there's lots and lots of neat rows of string, you know, all the way around, and it keeping it super tight. That product gets put into my walk-in fridge, which runs at like 2 degrees, and like I think of it as being the winter in there. I'm trying to sort of ape the traditional small holders way of doing things, right? I take an entire pig and I chop it up and turn it into different things. For this one thing, it needs to be in the winter for like 3 or 4 months. So in the south of France, where they might do this in a family environment, they'll kill the pig in October or early November. They'll put these things into salt and then they'll hang it in some outhouse or whatever. And the temperature, the natural temperature, is fridge temperature, so that the meat's not going off whilst the salt is entering in towards the core of the muscle. And then it gets put into the fridge until the salt is evenly sort of spaced, you know, if that makes sense. And then it's cured, but it's not ready by any stretch of the imagination. It needs to then get moved into my conditioning chamber, which runs at about 12 degrees, sort of like cool room temperature, with fairly high humidity. And it dries out very slowly over the next 12 to 18 months. So the finished product will come out and get eaten about 18 to 24 months after the pig has been killed. There's all kinds of magic things that happen, you know, like in these conditioning spaces. It just gets left, and there are microfauna, microflora, that do their sort of mysterious thing. I'm waving my fingers around in a kind of a magic way because it is a bit mysterious. But it's that time, and those natural things in the air, yeasts and this, that and the other, that can turn something very nice into something exceptional.
It's always nice to be recognised, always nice to receive praise for what you do. And I believe you've won an award recently as well for some of your products.
The fanciest one that I got was for my Jambon de Bayars, my Culatello style ham, that's sort of aged for 18 months to 24 months. I got a gold medal for that, and I think I finished second behind a very fancy acorn-fed Beata Iberico ham. I mean, those hams are the best hams in the world. Like, there's no shame in finishing second to one of them. So I was pretty delighted with a second place, to be honest. And a shiny gold medal, it's good. World Charcuterie Awards. It's the first time they've ever run it, so, you know. So it's a nice little feather in the cap. It's part of the story, you know. You can tell people a little gold sticker that goes on, and if someone's a bit unsure, it can sometimes seal a sale.
You've suggested that you use all of the pig. How does that translate into a range?
I absolutely use all the pig, yeah. Generally, I take mature animals that have got more depth of flavour to them as a result of them being old. If you think of like the difference between lamb and mutton or veal and beef, the older meat is darker and more flavoursome. But I'll take literally an entire pig, and I make two different products out of the head. I make four different types of salami. I'll do a copper, which is like a ham from the collar, the top of the shoulder, like the ribeye of on a beef you call it ribeye, and further down, like the sort of pork chop type cut, I do a cured pork loin, which is delicious actually. I do the ham that I was talking about before, the Culatello ham, the Jambon de Bayars. I do a belly, air dried belly, which I call ventrèche, which is the French word, the southwest France word for pancetta. Like I was saying before, it doesn't matter whether it's got the French name or the Italian name, except for perhaps for your marketing, because it's made by me in England using English pork anyway. Anyway, that's a really delicious thing to cook with, or to, if it's fully cured, you can eat it raw, like it's silky, and I'll get you to try some. It's like you just eat it like a ham, like a Serrano ham or whatever. I do a very trendy thing called guanciale, which is made from the cheek, the jowl. So it's an Italian delicacy, particularly in northern Italy. And if you want to make a carbonara, proper carbonara, then you need to have the cheek of bacon. I call it gula. It's a French word for the exact same thing. But most people know it as guanciale. I make a tureen. I call it the nose-to-tail tureen because it's made out of the head and the tail. And I've won awards for that one as well, actually. I won a gold award for that, and a top in its category at the British Charcuterie Awards. The salamis that I do, one of them is nduja, which is another very popular thing these days. So it's a soft, spreadable salami with, the way I do it, lots of roasted red pepper in it. So it's got a real distinct sweetness, but it's also spicy and smoked. I do like a chorizo, I do a fennel salami with some Aleppo chilies in it, which is a bit like what they have in a very niche thing in France that I used to work with a lot when I worked in southwest of France. Piment d'Espelette is a very artisanal product where they hang the peppers from the eaves of the houses in this little village in the Pyrenees called Espelette. Well, I can't afford that. But Aleppo peppers are very similar. They're dried in the sun in Turkey, and they've got a fruitiness and an almost smokiness through having been dried in the sun. And they're very mild, so they're not really spicy at all. But what they bring is fruitiness, interestingness, difficult to put your finger on-ness, you know? And anyway, so that goes really nicely with fennel. And that's a sort of Italian-style one. And I do a saucisse en sec, which is a more French-style. Lots of pepper, lots of garlic, red wine. And all these things, most of these things are air-dried. You know, they take anything from probably 4 weeks to 2 years to make. That's the core of my range. And then there's a couple of other things that I use to finish off using the animal. I do a ramen kit. So ramen is a Japanese broth that you eat with noodles, and special ramen noodles, and there's often like an egg in there and some bits of meat and whatnot. Well, I sell a ramen kit which is finished with some nduya and sesame and you know, some noodles, and then you put in whatever else you want. And that way I can use up the bones and some of the skin, and that sort of was the final piece in the jigsaw to completely use up the animal. I also make rillettes, which is like another brilliant way of using up the meat that's stuck to the bone. I'll slowly cook those bones with meat attached to them in pork fat with white wine and garlic and herbs and spices for hours and hours and hours until the place smells nice and it's fallen off the bone. You can pick that down then and turn it into like a rough paste, and that's rillette. Really traditional, rustic French sort of country food, you know.
It's something you don't see very often here outside of places like maybe Waitrose or M&S maybe. It's certainly an unusual product, and the taste is incredible.
For me, it reminds me of France. Me and my wife lived in France for 4 years. I studied French when I was a kiddywink as well, so I went to uni and lived in Paris for a year. And like rillette, jar of cornichons, you know the little pickled gherkins, sharp and vinegary and crunchy, glass of red wine and the baguette. It's like quintessential French comfort food, you know. You can get it anywhere and everywhere. Every boulangerie will do a rillette sandwich, you know, on a baguette, and you can just walk around the street doing it, or you can turn it into like a really quite delightful lunch. And for me, that's indicative of actual French country cooking, sort of Elizabeth David style, is really straightforward, simple, using the poorer quality cuts, because that's what poor people who developed these recipes, that was the only things they could have. You know, I feel some solidarity with those kind of people. And I like the traditional food of France and Spain and Italy and, you know, anywhere really, England as well.
How important is it for you to be in Liverpool? How do you think it makes such a difference to the way that you think about what you're doing with your food?
I've travelled around the world a little bit and we've lived in other countries and stuff, but Liverpool's my home, it's where I'm from, you know. The thing that's nice is that the farming in Britain is very high standard. And when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about small farms, you know, the conscientious kind of farms that I work with. So some of the best meat in the world is produced in this country, on our doorstep, like in the Wirral, in Cheshire. As far away as I'll go for a pig is from Yorkshire. And for me, that's really important. I can get those sort of fundamental ingredients from my doorstep and then turn them into something with character, you know.
From a very humble beginning, you make incredible products.
For me, what I do is cooking. Your personality comes through in the cooking, and that's the point of difference. What I do to it and my personality is the point of difference to some of the other products you might have. I'm not saying that they're not good, but they're slightly different to me, to my stuff, because of the way I choose to do things. I'm quite punctilious and careful about doing this and then this and then this. I don't cut any corners, you know. And as a result, the product turns out as it does, you know.
Just before we go and have maybe a quick scoop round, talk to me a little bit about how you smoke. Where do you source your stuff from and how does it work?
I've got a fairly Heath Robinson-style smoker, which is based on smouldering wood dust. And I use sweet chestnut chips. They are British sourced. It's got a really nice, sweet, gentle smoke. It's not as harsh as oak. My smoke products are sweet as a result of the wood and various other things that sort of all contribute towards a nice, sweet and round sort of flavour. I do nduya is cold smoked, and I do some smoked bacon as well, you know, from the belly. So streaky bacon, properly aged. They get smoked for 3 days normally. The process is the machine will smoulder for maybe 12 hours, and then you need to let it rest for another 12 hours, and then the next day you'll do 12 hours smoking, 12 hours resting, and then the third day the same again, and then it'll get dried until it's ready to eat. The technology is super basic, but the premise is that it does its thing naturally and slowly, and that sort of fits with my whole ethos of everything needs to be done naturally, slowly, correctly, don't cut any corners.
Obviously, at this point, I'm going to just warn the listener that there will be some sort of background noises because we got all sorts of machinery going on out there. But let's kind of look around, Ed. Right, so here we are then. We're outside of a large unit inside the unit. So what can we expect to see in here?
So this is the conditioning room. So this is where the hams and the salamis and whatnot age and develop flavour. So let's have a look, eh?
Yeah, open up. Oh, wow, look at that. Look at... Oh, smell. The smell hits you, Andy.
Yeah, it's the smell. That's it. That's what we wanted to keep as a surprise. In here, if how can you describe it? There's various salamis at various stages of doneness and mouldiness. we've got some sausage on there, some chorizo, some fennel ones. We've got some bigger cuts here, which is like the hams. We've got copper. That's the jambon de bayos, that one. I was talking about with all the string tied around it. We've got some smoked bacon, we've got some guanciale, we've got some andouille. I also keep my garlic in here that I get from Cheshire Market Gardens. She's great. And Lisa, she's called. And so to be able to use like really local, really fresh ingredients is like a big treat to me. I also keep in my sort of ready products in here. So you can see some of them have been backpacked so that they're not moving anywhere, and they'll stay in the condition that I want them to be at until I want to slice them and sell them, and that's it. Here you go. Oh, we've got some lardo there. Forgot about that. We haven't talked about lardo before. So that's just cured back fat, which is not everyone's cup of tea. Some people are a bit squeamish of it, but it's proper nice. Like it's just pure flavour on top of toast.
For someone who hasn't been in a room like this before, I mean, it is just the smell. The longer we've been in here, the more it gets to you. I can see now, looking at the product you were talking about before, the knotted products, just how much work's gone into that. It literally has been knotted, I don't know, dozens and dozens of times. It's incredible. And one thing that I've noticed as well, just standing in here, is the colours and the textures. It's so vibrant and rich, some of the stuff. There's a basket there with some what looks like lardons or something on them, and they've got some fantastic labels. Who does your labels?
So my wife Dot is an artist, and she does all the branding for the company, and she also generally gets the duff job of stamping it onto the actual packaging, you know, which takes a long time. Like we we could do it in a simpler way that would be quicker, but it wouldn't look as nice, and so. That's kind of not how we roll. So we do it the hard way, with a hand clamp one at a time. Part of it, we try and do everything ourselves. And that's the reality of running your own business, you know, especially on the scale at which I'm doing it. You know, to pay someone to come in and do that would make it unaffordable.
What an amazing room. So we're just walking around now. There's all sorts of silver polished surfaces, and then we've got lots and lots of racks with spice and stuff on them. Your smoker's over there in the corner, and there's another one of these big rooms here. And what we got in here?
We're in the butchery section now. So we've got a pretty industrial, fancy meat grinder and a meat mixer for making the sausage. You know, for making salamis, mixing the meat together in there. It churns round. This one is, it just cuts the meat nicely. We've got a butcher's block, and we've got a sausage table with a sausage stuffer. And, you know, some fairly boring tables and that, but they do their job, and lots of sharp knives. And another thing that I wanted to show you is, basically, you've come at a good time. Finished making salamis yesterday, and so I've got them fermenting. So the process is that the salamis get made, and then they need to be fermented for like 3 days at an elevated temperature, so that the pH, the acidity of the meat, goes down, becomes more acidic, and that is like a safety hurdle, and also gives a sort of a characteristic flavour that you get from dried salamis. So I'll open this product. Hopefully, you'll get another sort of noseful.
A waft. Let's have a look. Oh yeah.
So you can smell the wine and stuff. I only use really good quality wine. I use organic wine because I don't want to be putting in chemicals into a product that I'm spending so long making good in the first place. So here we've got some fresh andouille and some salami sticks at the back. We call them pigars because when they're finished, they look a bit like a cigar, you know. That's my wife with her branding. And then in here we've got different salamis.
Smoky, this one. Much more smoky, much more garlicky.
Yeah, so this one's garlicky. The salami, the sausage en sec. The chorizo's garlicky. A bit of smoked paprika in there as well. And then this one isn't garlicky, but there's a big sort of wine flavour that you're getting. I love the smell of the fresh mixes. It's like really quite heady.
And definitely you're getting the wine coming through there as well.
Yeah, the aromatic from the wine, you really get, and the garlic as well. So all those things combined with, there's fresh herbs, there's various nice things that is the reason why they taste nice, you know. But so this is running at like 20 degrees, probably shut the door. And it's going to stay at more at this, there's like a bit of a pattern, but basically at 20 degrees for 72 hours, and then it will get moved into the other room that we were in earlier, and then dry to the point at which it becomes edible.
What's this little room here?
This room next door, we've got a meat fridge, walk-in meat fridge, which is a bit noisiest again. And this is where we hang the carcasses when they come in, as well as it's my winter in here. So I've got the hams that need to be kept at cold temperature whilst the salt is penetrating. Some of that happens inside backpack bags. Some of it happens outside, you know, like open to the environment. And you can see in here, there's some meat that I'm going to be finishing this off later on today. It'll get wrapped up in a skin and that'll get moved into the conditioning room. So we've got some fresh whole mussel products that have just come out of salt. They've got some spices on them and stuff, but they're just drying out for a couple of days before I then apply some more spices and then move them into the conditioning room. And then above them, there are some hams that need to be in this room, open to the environment for, you know, 3 or 4 months before they then move over, because this, like I said, this is my winter room. And so they'll get moved over to sort of spring in the conditioning room next.
Just maybe to round off the experience that I've had today, anyone who hasn't tried your stuff, where can they get hold of it, and how can we explore your repertoire, as it were, more?
Okay, so this most straightforward way to get hold of my gear is on the website. I've got a website which is northbysoothwest.com. It's a bit of a funny spelling, but hopefully you can put a link or something. So it's north. The company is North, as in I'm from the north, and Sud-West, which is French for southwest, because I used to live in the southwest of France, and that's where my influence sort of mainly comes from. You can buy any of my products from my website, northbysoothwest.com. You can find me at farmers markets in Liverpool, Wirral and Cheshire. On the first Saturday of the month, I do Road Hall in Stoke. Bit of a trek from here, but it's okay, about an hour's drive. On the second Saturday, I do New Ferry, Birkenhead. There's a farmer's market in the morning in the village hall. On the third Saturday of the month, I do Allerton Road in South Liverpool. On the fourth Saturday of the month, I do Lark Lane Farmers Market. And the fourth Sunday of the month, I do Treacle Market, which is a great market in Macclesfield. Really sprawling, like takes up the entire town, really great. Good day out type market, you know. But you'll find me at all of those every month. You might find some bits and bobs in various restaurants across Liverpool. Nord, the fairly new restaurant in the business district. Barnacle in the Duke Street Market, upstairs in the Duke Street Market. We've got Tallulah's in New Brighton, a couple of places in Manchester, some other bits and bobs that are in sort of bubbling away.
One of the reasons you came onto my radar was the new bar that's just opened in College Road, Coop, yeah, and they're going to stock your products as well, aren't they? So,
yeah, that's right. They did a soft opening at the weekend, which was carnage. It was great. Some charcuterie boards for them, and there was a throng of, I think it was their friends and family and stuff. It was bouncing anyway. So hopefully that all went down well. And they're doing really great beer. Like, I was very impressed by the beer. I had one pint. Because I was working. But they were very insistent. Would you like a pint? I was like, I'll do my work and then I'll have a pint. But anyway, they're very friendly, lovely people. They're going to be doing charcuterie boards, cheese boards and great beer. And I think it's going to be a good place, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm going to have to twist your arm at your back before I go and have a tarpaulin and some stuff. But can I also maybe try and put something else on your radar that maybe there's possibly an opportunity for you to come down to the Baltic at some point and maybe set up a little stall somewhere? And because I'm sure the people down there are going to be all over this.
Yeah, why not, man? Why not?
Can't thank you enough for your time, Andy. It's been great to get a feel for what you're doing here. And please don't stop doing it. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much. We'll get you to come and try some bits now.
Well, that was Andy Rogers from North by Sudwest, based, of course, in Bootle. What an amazing story. What an amazing story.
I literally was down there for a couple of hours, Mick. He gave me the full guided tour. And it's just, when you pull up outside, as I said, it's just so unassuming. You've got a garage opposite doing MOTs. You've got, industrial units everywhere else. And then knock on the door, rung the bell, and in I went. And it's like an Aladdin's cave of pork. Yeah, it's amazing.
And there's definitely a market for that kind of food now, isn't there? More than there was, say, 10, 20 years ago. I mean, in Liverpool city centre, you've got Lunya, the Catalan restaurant, just to name one, but there are many, many more. And the fact that they're working with Edges, and I've known that company for 20-odd years, and they're award-winning as well. So there is a market for it. And it's great that he went to the south of France, to the Pyrenees, to learn his trade there and work there as a chef. And the fact that he's brought those skills back here is just wonderful, isn't it, you know?
Well, he says in the interview that we are so lucky to be literally surrounded in Cheshire by so many amazing farmers. And he has such a lot of good things to say about Edge's butchery in New Ferry. Just for me, what really pours out of that interview is the amount of work and dedication and just craft that Andy pours into that product. And man, can you taste it? We had a sit down and we had a little bit of lunch afterwards, and you can just taste the love, the care, the attention that he's put into it. It's amazing. Yeah.
And it's something when you go abroad, anywhere in the Mediterranean or anything like that, you really do notice the quality there, don't you? And so that's what makes it even more special that Andy's now doing that on our doorstep. While I was at the BBC many moons ago, I was lucky enough to direct a national BBC series of programmes on TV, radio and online called BBC Voices. It was all about accent and dialect in the UK, and I loved every minute of it. One of our academic partners at the time was the University of Leeds, who have a first-class reputation in linguistics, and they did some amazing work with us, mainly behind the scenes, making sure we covered as many accents and dialects as possible throughout the four home nations. Well, Professor Tony Crowley is a Liverpool-born linguist based at Leeds University, and his new book, Liverpool, A Memoir of Words, is an accessible deep dive into the famous Scouse dialect, as it used to be and as it is today. It's his third book about Liverpool English, and it's been described as a work of creative non-fiction, very readable and fun, but with lots of social and linguistic references that we can all relate to. And in particular, too, he blows apart a few myths about the origins of Scouse, as I found out when I met up with him over Zoom recently.
Actually, my real interest in Liverpool English came, I left the country, I went to the United States for about 9 years, 10 years, and went to teach in a university over there. And that the sort of distance thing gave me a renewed interest in it. I sort of like perspective, a little sort of expatriate thing in a way, you know. And I started getting interested in the story of Scouse. But I started thinking about the story, and I started thinking about the story that I knew, which was, you know, the story of the history of Scouse, which was the story that Frank Shaw invented in 1950. Frank Shaw was the first person to refer to Scouse, to Liverpool English as Scouse, and he does it in an article in the Liverpool Echo in 1950. Scouse before that, as we all know, Scouse had meant a dish, except originally it wasn't Scouse, it was lobscouse. That was the original term. And that's first recorded in 1708. And then the Oxford English Dictionary says, in Liverpool by 1840, and so their first example is from 1840, people are using the term Scouse. Actually, it's a lot earlier than that in Liverpool. I found in the records of the Liverpool poorhouse in the 1790s, there's a recipe for Scouse. Actually, Scouse, not lobscouse, Scouse. So it's already being used in the city in that shortened form. Now, the reason I mention that is because that's interesting, because one of the things that Liverpool people do in terms of speech is they shorten words. There's constant sort of abbreviation of words.
I mean, the Aussie and all that stuff.
I mean, there's masses of them. But that's a long-standing feature of Liverpool English. So I got interested in the story. I said, where did that story come from? Yeah. What I found out was that the story is based on an account which really says, Frank Short said, okay, Liverpool English, or Scouse, he called it Scouse. Scouse is a combination of Lancashire dialect plus the language of Irish English, the language of the immigrants who came from Ireland fleeing the famine in the 1840s. Now, I like that story, you know, because I think it's a good story. It's a Liverpool Irish story. You know, my family were Liverpool Irish, so it was a good story, and that was the story I knew. It was the standard story. Actually, in some ways, it's still the standard history. And then I started thinking about it, and I started thinking, does that really make sense? Not least because all of those people who came from Ireland, I mean, they wouldn't have been speaking Irish English. They would have been speaking very different forms of Irish English. You know, people who come from Cork don't sound like people who come from Mayo or Dublin or whatever. So they don't be speaking different forms of it. So I started thinking, does that really make sense? And then I thought, well, I wonder where Frank Shaw gets it from. The other thing I did was to check population figures, and the population figures don't really bear out Frank Shaw's story. So that sort of alarm bells started going off in my head about, hold on, maybe there's something wrong with, because there's a lot of popular stories about language, myths about language. And then when you start investigating them, like, they sort of fall apart. So I started looking at population figures, and then I started reading. I started reading a lot of Liverpool history, and I found that there's some evidence at the end of the 18th century that already by the end of the 18th century, there's a sense that the spoken language of the city of Liverpool is distinctive, that people are sort of aware of the fact that it's different from the surrounding districts. Now, so I said, okay, why would that be? Why would that happen? Now, you look at the population figures. Liverpool in 1701 is a fishing village, effectively, or fishing town of 5,000 people, not very big. By the end of the century, because originally the Baltic trade, but then the slave trade, particularly the slave trade, the city just explodes. So by the end of the population, it's 77,000. That's a massive increase. Can't possibly be explained by endogenous growth, like, it's not otherwise, you know, every family would have had to have like 40 kids. So it's not that. And then there's this historian of Liverpool called William Enfield, and in 1768 publishes a book, 1768, called The History of Liverpool. The name's not even settled at that point. It's actually called Liverpool, in which he talks about, and this is a quote, a constant influx of strangers, which means like the population of Liverpool is growing and growing and growing because people are coming to the city from other places, from abroad, also from within the rest of Britain. And that's in the 19th century. That's a process which, as I said, exploded before. It really does explode in the 19th century. So it goes from 5,000 in 1700, 1701, 77,000 by 1801. And at the end of the century, it's nearly 700,000. So it's like an amazing explosion. And it's only explicable by immigration. And if you look at the figures for 1861, for example, 1861 census, half of the population are immigrants. Now, half of the half, like 25% of the people are from Ireland, but 25% of the people are from elsewhere. And that's really fascinating. So what we know in language study is that a mix of people, when you get a mix of people bringing all sorts of different languages and cultures together, you get new linguistic forms being created. So I started to think, maybe Frank Shaw's story is a bit too simple. There's no doubt about it that there's an Irish influence in Liverpool. Of course there is. You know, there's a big Irish influence. But there's all this other stuff as well. So it led me to start sort of doing a lot of research on it. And the more I researched in it, the more I realized that people are commenting on Liverpool being a multilingual place in the 19th century, that there's lots and lots and lots of languages spoken in Liverpool, and there's people who are coming to Liverpool, speaking their own language, and then learning English in Liverpool and so on. Okay, that type of crucible, if you like, that's a classic example of how new languages, new linguistic forms are created. Now, the interesting thing about Liverpool English is, in Britain, there's a dialect continuum, right, across the country, north and south, but also east and west, such that each dialect, as it sits next to the dialect alongside it, it's similar to that dialect, but slightly different. So, as you pass along the chain, the differences become greater. So an easy example is, if you think about Newcastle and Sunderland, you know, to outsiders, they sound the same. To insiders, they probably sound slightly different. You know, people from Newcastle claim that they can tell if someone's from Sunderland and vice versa. But to outsiders, it would probably sound the same. If you get from Newcastle to Leeds, of course, along the dialect continuum, so a number of along. Now, in some ways, they've got a lot of features in common, northern features, you would say that, but they don't sound like each other. No one would say, okay, Newcastle and Leeds sound the same. So the further you get along the chain, the more different it will sound, but there are similarities, and it's linking all the way along. Likewise, Leeds and Manchester. Okay. Now, this model works. It works perfectly right along the dialect continuum until you get, at least till relatively recently, until you get to a certain point in Prescott Road, and then it stops. Right? And then it's completely different. It's like nothing else. Like Liverpool English and Scouse is like, it doesn't sound like anything to the north of it or the east of it or to the south. It's completely distinctive.
Is that still the case, Tony?
That is still the case, yeah. Yeah.
Because this is the third book you've written about Scouse, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's the situation now? How is it changing now, would you say, Tony? If you could take the temperature on the way people speak now, and people, okay, I don't know what age group you want to look at, but it is changing all the time, isn't it?
Here's the thing, Mick. Here's the really interesting thing about it. So dialects are always dying, right? People are always saying dialects are dying. They've been dying since the 19th century. They're not dying, as it turns out, they're not dying. And actually, there's some research that's just come out in the last few days that said they're changing, but they're not dying. But in the 19th century, they said railways will destroy dialects, right? Because people will be moving around. And then they said paid public holidays would destroy dialects because all these working class people would, you know, they'd all be going to Blackpool, they'd all be mixing, and that would eradicate dialects. Okay, so that didn't happen. So railways didn't destroy it. Paid public holidays didn't destroy it. The next thing that was done to destroy it was television and radio, okay? Like broadcast, that didn't destroy it. And then they talked about education, and that was going to destroy it. It hasn't. The really interesting thing about Liverpool English, Scouse, is that it's a highly stigmatized form. So they do these surveys all the time called the Language Attitude Surveys, and it's attitudes to particular accents, but also linguistic form. And Liverpool comes next to bottom. Birmingham is bottom, but Liverpool comes next to bottom. And it's consistent. It's over and over and over and over again. Okay. Here's the really strange and interesting thing about that. It's very highly stigmatized, and yet it's spreading, Mick. So now, if you go to St. Helens now, the younger generation in St. Helens sound as though they come from Liverpool. The kids from St. Helens sound as though they come from Liverpool. The older generation, and particularly the older generation, they sound like, to use a term which some people might find offensive, they're woollybacks, right? I mean, like the older generation, but the kids sound as though they come from Liverpool. If you go to Widnes, exactly the same thing is happening. Now, Runcorn is different because Runcorn was effectively a new town built with people from Liverpool. But if you go, and same with Skem, but Liverpool English seems to be pushing up towards Wigan, out towards St. Helens, down past Widnes, into North Wales.
Yeah, definitely North Wales. I mean,
definitely North Wales, you know. Yeah. So that's a real linguistic conundrum. And why, if it's so stigmatized, why is it spreading? Now, the good and bad news is I don't know. It's a research project, but I don't know. And we don't know, not yet. It's also becoming, I gave a talk the other day, and one of my nephews said, but there's loads of words that you use that we don't use. And I said, and vice versa. I mean, there's loads of words that
you
know, the kids use I wouldn't use. But it's changing all the time. But in many ways, there's a couple of phoneticians, like students of sound, and they're looking at Scouse, and they say Scouse. The interesting thing about Scouse, particularly in the younger generation, is that Scouse features are becoming stronger and more pronounced. I think the explanation for that is because, particularly over the last 40 years, but maybe even more recently than that, there's been a development around Liverpool identity and a real sort of very strong sense of Liverpool identity as being almost self-enclosed in some ways. You know, I mean, a lot of it's got to do with politics and the way in which, you know, Liverpool was cut off from the rest of the country in some ways, you know. So there's a sort of development of a pride, almost a defiance, I think, and it comes through linguistically, and it comes through in terms of, you know, how do we signal our solidarity with each other and our identity with each other? We do it linguistically.
But when I was a kid, I'm about the same age as you, a little bit older. When I was a kid in the 60s, my mum and dad, I was brought up in quite a posh part of Liverpool, Chilwell. Right. My mum and dad sometimes used to tell me off for, you know, talking like a scally. They wouldn't use that word, but they would say, don't say that, say this.
Yeah.
And I think less of that goes on now within the environment of Liverpool. So middle-class people now speak with a stronger accent, I think, than they would have done in the mid-60s.
I think that's right. I think you're right there, Mick. There's a lot of ambivalence towards Scouse historically. Particularly middle-class ambivalence towards Scouse. And there's a lot of that, you don't want to sound like them. I mean, today you would say scally. But I think you're right. I think a lot of that has changed. And again, I mean, it's to do with, you know, what is it that makes us Liverpoolian? You know, coming from the city, identifying with the city, you know, football, a number of different things, cultural things. But language is a central part of it. And I think language has become more of a part of it over about the last maybe 40 years, maybe more recently than that, but much more than it was in the past, I think. A sort of self-conscious part of it. And I think that's more developed than it was in the past. But that's definitely right, I think, about the attitudes, like middle-class attitudes towards Scouse in the 1960s were pretty severe at times.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's talk about your book, because you've taken this A to Z for, you know what, I nearly said A to Z then. You've taken this, God blimey, you've taken the A to Z format and you've started, I think, with ace, which is a word you don't hear much now. Just talk us through some of the words, just pluck them out of the book, if you would, Tony, because it's not strictly speaking an academic book at all, is it? I mean, one of the people who reviewed it called it a work of creative nonfiction.
Right.
And you've had someone like Frank Cottrell Boyce saying it's a goldmine of a book. Well, you know, great kudos. So what will we get from the book when we buy it?
Okay, what I was not interested in doing is writing a personal memoir, right? I'm not old enough or important enough to write a memoir, I'm afraid to say. But what I wanted to do was to write a book about Liverpool English which was scholarly. So there's a lot of history of the language in it, and but also a lot of social history in it. So, and there is a lot of social history. But there's also me in it, because I'm a firm believer that good research comes from you. I mean, you've got to have a sort of personal investment and a personal stake in it, in a way. And I wanted to write about what it was like growing up in Liverpool, working class Liverpool, and then go through the education system. And then realizing, you know, as I said before, about, you know, your language being different and so on, and you know, going to Oxford, and then I became a professor of English language. So I wanted to write the way in which language and a particular type of language is mixed up with all of those different things together at one and the same time. You know, we're speaking a historical form of the language, we're speaking a very particular historical form of the language, but you know, that developed within a particular social history. You know, and it developed within people, you know, and I was one of those people who happened to speak it. So I wanted to, it's like a hybrid book in lots of ways, and I wanted to sort of mesh those things together. So for it not to just be another academic book, I sort of feel as though I've done that. But I didn't want it to be just a personal memoir as well. So, I mean, a good example of a word from the book is bommy. Oh, the other thing I wanted to write about was the way in which words are really essential part of memory, you know, like personal memory, but also social memory, but personal memory, like there are particular words which for any of us, I think, not just people from Liverpool, but for any of us, there are particular words which are bound up with childhood and notions of childhood, memories of childhood and so on and so on. So there's one word in the book, which is bommy, which is bonfire. You know, there's so much of my childhood which is tied up with building bonfires.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know, and loving bonfires.
Same here. Yeah,
you know, all of that. So I wanted to write about that work. Now, here's the thing about a bonfire. So what I do is I take bommy and then I look at words. You know, I give an account of building a bonfire when you're a kid, different types of bonfires. You know, like where we lived in the Dingle, you built bonfires twice a year. There was bonfire night. But on Good Friday,
yes,
we built a bonfire, and that was burning Judas. And it was like, you know, early in the morning. And I did some research on this, and actually that's a Mediterranean cultural practice. You know, that's where it comes from. As far as I can make out, I think it comes from Portuguese sailors in the 19th century who did it. They settled in Liverpool and they did it. And it's in a very particular area of the Dingle, or it was in a very particular area of the Dingle. But that was Good Friday. But the real, you know, the real show, obviously, was, bonfire night started in September, and, you know, collecting wood, collecting money, deciding when to take the guy out and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, but also what I do in the book is to take words like that and say, okay, you know, I know this word. Do I? Bonfire, right? So my best mate at school, I said to him, wonder where bonfire comes from, yeah? And he said, oh, it's French, bonfire, like good fire, you know. So I'm like, okay. Anyway, so I believed that for a long time, you know, and then I did the sensible thing and looked it up. And of course, it's not to do with French. You know, in the medieval period, at Midsummer, so way before Guy Fawkes came along, in Midsummer, they had bone fires. So there were fires for burning bones. That's where it comes from, bonfire. So that leads you into, like, so there's another big social history involved in that, you know.
Can I ask you one question that has intrigued me as well? Young lads in Liverpool, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, or some of them in some parts of the city, you know, they talk to each other, la, la. LA was the term of endearment. And now the young kids say lad.
Yeah.
What happened there? Because you'd expect it, or at least I would expect it. maybe not known as much as you do. To be the other way around, they'd call them lad then and lad now, and it would be shortened. Well, how come a change like that happens?
That's a really interesting question, that, because originally, of course, it was lad.
Yeah.
And then it gets shortened to la. And now it's lad again. I've noticed that when I go to the match sometimes, you know, I'm listening. I mean, it's an occupational hazard, I'm afraid, you know, but I'm listening, yeah. And the kids say lad. It's a generational thing. It's to distinguish themselves from the generation above. That's what they're doing it for. They don't say la because that's what the dads say.
Fair enough, yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. You don't want to talk like your dad, do you?
You don't want to sound like your dad. As my nephew pointed out to me the other day, you know, we don't sound like you and we don't say the same things. And which is fine, you know. But what they don't realise, of course, is that, well, we did that as well. And the generation before us did that as well. You know? So yeah. There's nothing new about it. You know?
No. Well, look, lovely to speak to you, Tony. The book is by Tony Crowley, Professor Tony Crowley. It's a memoir of words, and it's published by Liverpool University Press. Tony, thanks for joining us today. Wonderful to speak to you.
You're very welcome, Mick. Thanks very much.
Tony Crowley there. Mick, that was an amazing interview. Again, as you said at the beginning of the interview, he does kind of cast a bit of an aspersion on where some of the origins of some of these things come from. You know, his references left me thinking that he was more convinced that it was more to do with the transient nature of the dialects that we were getting in through the port rather than what I would traditionally think of as the Welsh and Irish influences.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Irish influence was massive. He's not denying that, but he thinks that the way in which the Scouse dialect has developed over the years may be the part of other languages and dialects has been underplayed a little bit. But I mean, wasn't it fascinating when he said that even in the, was it the 18th century, end of the 18th century, people were saying from outside the area, the people in Liverpool spoke differently to the rest of Lancashire. And I'd never heard that one before. So, no, Tony's a great guy. He's going to be in Liverpool again over the next couple of months, so I hope to see him then. He did a talk not long ago at Central Library, and it was chocker. So it's a really good book. I haven't read it yet, but I'll take it from the reviews that I've seen that it's a really good book. It's called Liverpool, A Memoir of Words. It's published by Liverpool University Press, and the author is Tony Crowley.
One fascinating part of the interview for me, Mick, as well, was when he was talking about coming to the end of Prescott Road and suddenly the accent changes without any discernible reference point anywhere else. Uniquely Liverpool, I think.
It's great because he blows the myth that dialects are dying. They're not dying. They're changing all the time. And I think for many years, people thought, as he said, people have been saying dialects are dying since the 19th century. They're not, they're changing. And he's there at the sharp point of that. And it'll change again over the next 5-10 years. And it was weird to hear him say it's spreading as well. So young people in St. Helens, they're growing up talking Scouse rather than the St. Helens dialect.
Well, it's great to hear that the Scouse accent is taking over the country, at least, Mick.
Yeah, you haven't got one yet. Although, when you go back to London, do your mates say to you, hang on, where'd you get that one from?
Why would I want to go back there?
Yeah, but people must say to you, or has your voice not changed at all, your accent?
It's a hard one to say, really. I think what I need to do is to sit down with the professor and let him examine earlier recordings of me. But I think it would only be a positive thing for me to be so steeped and dipped in Scouse that I somehow pick up the accent. I wouldn't mind that at all.
Well, maybe we can start up some Scouse lessons for you, you know.
Very nice. I'll read the book. Maybe that'll help.
All right, mate. Okay.
So, Mick, we are, as I said earlier, looking for a new sponsor. And if you do feel as though there's an opportunity for your business to sponsor us, it doesn't have to be a long-term thing. We're always interested in looking at every single opportunity that comes our way and looking at the mutual benefits to it. Like I said, we tell positive stories about Liverpool, and we would be delighted to talk to anybody who had an interest in becoming part of this.
Yeah, sure. And the email address that you need to send it to?
As I said, it's info@baltictrianglepodcast.com. That's info@baltictrianglepodcast.com. Well, that's just about it for us for this episode. Let me just give you the spelling of North by Sudwest. It's North, as in the English version, N-O-R-T-H, by, B-Y. Sud is the French one. It's S-U-D, and then there's a little dash. And West is O-U-E-S-T. That's North by Sudwest, and they're based in Bootle. Do check them out on all the social media platforms and their website.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next month. All the best.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.